just wanted to welcome everybody to today's cyber seminar. I'm very pleased to present some work that we've been working on here on risk adjustment for cost data and the development and implementation of the what's known as the V21 and the Gnosis systems, and we'll give you more detail on that. But these systems are designed to replace the venerable DXCG systems that have been used in the VA in the past, and I'll provide more detail on that. This is a large number of people have contributed to this work. We've had people here at HERC in our COIN Center, which is called CI to I. We've got people over at Operational Analytics and Reporting, mainly Peter Almanoff, who's helped with funding, the Office of Productivity, Efficiency, and Staffing. We couldn't have done it without them, and in fact, they're the operational partner that's going to be running much of these models and providing them on the CDW in the future. And doing so already, so it's mailing Xian Chen has just been tremendously helpful there. And then others have provided comments and feedback, including Bruce Gnosian, Amy Rosen, and Maria Montez Roth. And I apologize if I forgot anybody there. If I did, my sincere apologies. It really has been a huge effort. So just to give you a brief outline, I'm going to sort of stand this cyber seminar on its head. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on risk adjustment for cost data, and then I'm going to jump right into sort of the availability of these new scores. I think that some people are on this line just to find out more about how to access the scores. And then if you're interested in hanging out, we'll talk more about the development of the models and the statistical comparability across the risk models. But for those of you who just wanted to know more about how to access these data, I just wanted to make sure that that was up front. And feel free to ask questions as you go. We have the GoToWebinar seminar series thing here. I can see the questions. We also have Risha Goodwani, who's going to be helping me with the questions. And she may interrupt me if I just keep going and I don't see the slides or the questions. So, okay, so just introduction, what is risk adjustment? At least I think of it as a statistical method to adjust for the observable distances between patients. And often we're trying to classify patients into homogeneous clinical categories. And then in many cases, we're trying to calculate a single dimension risk score using these clinical categories. And there are many times that we use risk adjustment. And I will make a distinction between risk adjustment that is done for payments versus risk adjustment that's done for most health services research. So the goal is to identify opportunities for improvement and develop test innovations. Risk adjustment, if we're trying to do that, is critical to almost all of the big data set analyses that we need to do. Often we see in these observational data a considerable amount of confounding, and one of the questions is, let's try to remove different clinical differences between these patients to make a valid comparison. There are many risk adjustment systems out there, and let me just highlight some of these. Some are designed specifically for cost data, and others are not. I had thought up, Heidi, about a poll question. I wasn't sure if we had done polls for these.
We do have them set up, but it is not letting me pull them up here for some reason.
That's fine. What I had hoped to find out is people's familiarity with these different systems. So let me just run through the list. And if you're able to get them pulled up, we'll do so. So one of the ones that we've used in the past has been the Risk Smart solution for DCG made by Verisk. Another one that many people are familiar with is the Charlson Comorbidity Index. This is in part goes back many, many years and was designed to look at inpatient data. Many people are familiar now with the CAN score, which was developed by Steve Finn and his group. That has not been designed specifically to look at cost information. That's been mostly used to look at information on hospitalization and mortality in a one-year period. There are other proprietary systems, ACGs, also known as adjusted clinical groups. There is a system that's freeware out of it's often designed for payments and trying to come up with adequate payments for health plans, specifically Medicaid plans. And then CMS, which is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has a risk adjustment model known as what we're using here is the V21 model. And then Gnosis is sort of the latest addition. It's what we've been creating to go on top of that. So those are different risk adjustment systems. What I was hoping to get a sense on, here are three that I think of people as using heavily for non-cost data. Heidi, have we had any luck pulling up the poll?
No, not yet. It's just kind of it's just kind of circling on me. It doesn't want to go anywhere right now.
Okay. So I was hoping to get a sense of, if you want to just raise your hand, I can then look out into the audience and see how many people have used the Charlson, the Lixhauser, and CAN index. It's a little hard for me to see your hand virtually, so thank you for raising them. These are much more commonly used for cost data, the ACGs. CMGs is a system developed by 3M Software, DXCG, CDPS, and then the V21. So I was hoping to get a sense on these were mostly designed for either large data sets with clinical information or for costs themselves. As you can immediately see, there are many different risk platforms out there. So it's not to say that this is the only one. It's the V21 and the Gnosis is one of many. And then I wanted, there's also risk systems that use pharmacy information, and as you'll see later on, pharmacy information seems to matter a lot. And so I was curious about how many people have used these two risk scores. One is called RX risk, and another one is called Medicaid RX. But given that we can't do the poll, I will not ask you to raise your hands. So, risk adjustment systems. Well, I just want to give you a brief background on these things. Often it's used to identify clinical groups, and here are some in the, on the right-hand side in the green ones that do that. So Charlson, if you're familiar with it, goes through a record and identifies based on ICD-9 diagnostic codes patients in specific categories and then makes clinical groupings, and so you get a clinical group score out of it. DXCG, depending on which version you are using, goes through in excruciating detail and creates hierarchical classification categories, HCCs, and also creates a risk score. V21 is Medicare's version of a risk plan to pay Medicare Advantage plans, and that's one of the newer versions out there. ACG is John Hopkins' version of a risk plan. It does not come up with a single risk score. It is just comes up with these also these HCCs or hierarchical condition categories in great detail as well. Now, sometimes and in some cases, people want to create a single summary risk score. If you're looking at all of these, for example, the DXCG, depending on which version, you might have 394 clinical conditions. And so sometimes that multidimensionality can make it challenging to use those risk scores. And so at some points you might want to have a single risk score that's just numeric that allows you to risk adjust with a single risk score. And here are three different of systems that actually create risk scores. So as you can see, for example, ACGs does not create its own risk score. It just creates the condition categories as the Charlson. But with DXCG and V21, for example, they actually create a risk score for you. There's a distinction when we get into cost data about what is it we're trying to risk adjust. And often risk adjustment is needed to estimate the present clinical risk of a population. And so you might be interested in saying, well, given our clinical data that we have on this patient, what's the likelihood of them using care this year and what's the sort of risk adjustment of that cost data this year? There are many times where people are interested also in estimating future risk, and you could specifically be interested in that if you're interested either in health services or in payments. And so you might be interested, for example, in risk of a readmission in the next year or the risk of being more costly in the next year so you could adjust your payments appropriately. In time and cost data, there's two terms that come up time and time again, and I'll say these and be very specific about them because you'll see throughout the remainder of the cyber seminar that it does matter. Concurrent is to use the current diagnostic information, typically from a fiscal year. So if we say concurrent, it's using fiscal year 13 data to predict the same year's expenditures or costs. If you will, this places a greater importance on acute conditions than you might a prospective risk adjustment system. Prospective, which is the second bullet, uses the current year diagnosis to predict the next year's expenditures. And you might say, well, that's particularly important for chronic conditions where perhaps in payments you're interested in understanding people's underlying health conditions and how that might affect their next year's expenditures or costs. And that's called prospective. So hopefully everybody gets an idea that concurrent is using the current diagnostic information to predict current year costs. Prospective is you're using current diagnostic information to predict the next year's expenditures or costs. I don't presume to say one is better than the other. We often get questions about, is there a right time horizon? And I will say that intuitively, one can imagine prospective is making a little bit more sense, that you're trying to understand your current risk related to, or your current diagnostics related to your next year's expenditures, that there is somehow a time sequence there that you worry a little bit if you're using concurrent models, that you're just understanding how well they coded the data this year relative to their cost this year, and it's a little bit of a chicken the egg. I do, having had many conversations with this, understand that there are pros and cons to both systems, so I don't want to say that one system is always better than the other. Sometimes depends on the use. Risk and reimbursement. So there's a great desire outside of VA to risk adjust for reimbursement. Medicare uses their risk adjustment systems to pay Medicare Advantage plans. In VA, that's a little bit different. VA has its own risk adjustment system, which it's called VERA, the Veterans Equitable Resource Allocation System, for determining how much money is sent to the VISNs, and then the VISNs determine how much money is sent to each facility. And what we're doing here with NOSOS and P21 is not designed to affect payments. It's mostly used for whether you're interested in efficiency or other health services research questions. When you're dealing with questions of reimbursement, there's a big issue about gaming. And by gaming, I mean that people are very worried about creating a system that creates financial incentives to game the system so that places get higher payments. And so when we've had conversations with CMS about modifying V21 to include pharmacy data, there have been questions about, well, would that just create incentives for people to do a much better job or possibly even to dispense pharmaceuticals so that they get higher reimbursements? And so I just want to be very clear, because VA has its own method of payments, that really what I'm talking about is using risk adjustment for health services research, not for payments per se. So I'm trying to keep those separate, but there is a very fine line between those, and hopefully that's not confusing to people. So risk adjustment, there are people at VA who are using risk adjustment for operations, and there's also people in research using risk adjustment. Largely, I think of them as using very similar questions. Often the operations, what I've seen is more interest in real-time data, whereas in research, often we're asking questions that might be a couple years delayed. One of the challenges for this project, and a huge, again, thanks to the OPUS folks, has been helping me understand how to do something in real time. It's very easy as a researcher to say, well, I'm really focused on FY11, FY12, FY13 data that's already been processed and cleaned. It's much more difficult to develop a system that's going to get done quarterly in real time. So, for example, here are two questions where you might want to use risk adjustment. One is perhaps you're interested in understanding VA medical center efficiency and productivity, and you realize that different medical centers have different patient populations, and you want to adjust for the underlying clinical severity and risk of those populations. Perhaps a second question might be that you're conducting health services research and you're using administrative data, maybe the MedSAS data sets, and you're interested in developing a new innovative program and you're researching that. Again, you might want to risk adjust your population with your observable data. Historically, VA contracted with a company called VeriRisk to calculate risk scores for VA data. And VeriRisk is the company that made the DXCGs. So there are different platforms for VeriRisk. So the first one that I think of is called the RISC-SMART algorithm. This is an algorithm that created 184 condition categories, or these hierarchical condition categories, and it also created a risk score. This eventually gets updated. People have new information. They build up a new version. It's sort of like updating from Windows 95 to Windows 98. It keeps getting updated. Bear Risk at one point phased out RISC-SMART and moved to a new version called Risk Solutions, which created 394 HCCs. So as you can see, a significantly greater specificity in the condition categories and risk scores. There was a question that came up to VA about, does VA want to continue this contract with Bear Risk and continue purchasing the software and having the software run it quarterly? That's an expensive contract. And so the question came back, should it be a sole source contract? Should VA develop its own system? Should VA possibly use a different system? And so we were asked to support that question and the analytics behind it. And we focused on the latter, given that Bear Risk was going to be moving away from RISC-SMART, even though VA had used it. We were focusing on risk solutions and comparing risk solutions to other existing softwares out there. So we're going to, the remainder of this talk is going to talk on the risk solutions, which is the 394 HCCs. So just hereafter, if there's any clarity, when I say DHCG, just for simplicity, it refers to the risk solution model. And you have to be a little bit careful here because the model itself produces three risk scores. And these three risk scores have different uses. One is a Medicare with prospective risk model without any pharmacy data going into it. Another one is a Medicare concurrent risk without pharmacy. And then finally, you can assume that it's a Medicaid risk model, so it's been built on a Medicaid population, and it includes the pharmacy. So the first two, just to go through this again, is one's a prospective, one's concurrent. They're both Medicare. They're both without pharmacy. The third one is prospective, but it has pharmacy data in it. So we're going to compare all three and use all three in our tabulations that you'll see out there. And what we're going to do is we compared it to the CMS version 21. This generates 189 HCCs, although I should be very careful here, even though it generates all these HCCs, only 89 of them are used in creating the summary risk score. It then produces three prospective risk scores, one for community, one for institution, and one for new enrollee. And keep in mind, this was Medicare, so if you're a new enrollee, you get a slight bump in your risk. There is no concurrent risk score. So already we're facing this compatibility. It easily has three perspectives, and you might say, well, let's compare Bear Risk perspective with the community from the CMSV21 perspective. But you can already see that there might be a disconnect in terms of concurrent. So then we talk at length about how to create a new model, which we call Gnosis. And Gnosis is Greek for chronic disease. And so V21 risk scores, and as you'll see if you hang out, didn't do as well as the DXCG models in many of the regression specifications. The DXCG models do quite well. And so one of the questions was, well, VA sits on this wealth of data, clinical information. Could we add more detail to these models and come up with a model that does as well? And so that's what we were trying to do. And so the Gnosis represents that sort of Gnosis view version one, which is what we think of as trying to get most of the way there to developing a model that can replace the DXCG. We produce prospective and concurrent scores with this Gnosis model. So if you're interested in accessing these risk scores, and I see that there's a question about the hearing, and I'm hoping people have resolved that. Do you know, Heidi, whether people have been able to resolve the hearing issue?
I've only heard from one person that the audio had dropped off. I'm able to hear it fine. I'm not hearing it from anyone else, so it may just be a local issue. People are usually very upfront, very quick to tell me if the audio has dropped off.
Got it. So hopefully at this point, the audio's back, and hopefully at this point you understand a little bit about why you might want to risk adjust if you aren't familiar with risk adjustment. So let me just jump into the access to these risk scores, and then what I want to come back to is how we develop the risk scores and really set the stage for, I do not see this as any way a final product. What I see this as is a sort of the first stage in developing what I hope is a system that could be modified by users like you to create a much more robust risk score for VA in the future for access to these data. There we go. So SAS data sets are available right now from fiscal year 2006 to fiscal year 14. This is the CDW at 15 server, and there's a folder called risk scores. You will need permission to be able to access these. There's also SAS programs available on the Vinci SAS grid, so you can see how these were actually created with all the macros. John Cashy, I can't remember if he was on the list of people, has been just phenomenal supporting this. He was a programmer here at HERC and moved on to Pittsburgh, and he continues to help us a lot, even though he's no longer here. So, again, a big thanks to John Cashy for all of that work. So if you need access to NOSOS or V21, my first contact point is Mei-Ling Chen. So she's with Opus, and she's been helping us develop and run these in real time, and that's her email and phone number. We've been doing briefings with different operational groups so that operations understand these risk scores and that we can get them populated into. I know she's been working on SQL tables as well. We've also created a technical report, and that just sits on our website, and so you should be able to see that technical report. It describes the SAS programs and the input data sets, and so hopefully people can go through that and get a better sense of what that technical report looks like. And then finally, I should say, we have a paper that's under review at Health Services Research that's a revise and resubmit, and my hope is to get that revised and resubmitted in the next month, and reviewers have given us excellent comments and so forth. So at some point, we hope to have a paper out there that is in the peer-reviewed literature describing this model. Let me tell you a little bit about the data updates and availability of these data. So Mei-Ling Chen is creating these quarterly. So there are annual updates for full fiscal year of Q1 through Q4 of utilization, and then, as I said, quarterly updates use the most recent quarters. And so, for example, if you're doing the first quarter of 15 now, you are actually using a rolling year to calculate that. You need the rolling year both of clinical information as well as cost of data. That sort of moves forward, and the technical report highlights all of that information out there. So the year, though, is very critical for the clinical. You wouldn't want to just use one quarter for clinical information. You get a very attenuated snapshot of their clinical risk if you just use a quarter of data. The data updates pull a bunch across a bunch of data sets. We pull all the ICD-9 and demographic data from the MedSAS, CDW. We get a lot of questions about what's going to happen with ICD-10. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that Medicare will have to revise its V21 to handle ICD-10, and so the belief is that we will also have to retool ours to handle ICD-10. I just don't have the full knowledge at this point about how much that's going to change the system. I do know that it's going to be a fair amount of work. We use non-VA care, so the fee base is purchase care. We use that as well. There's the diagnostic information there. We take the priority information from the ADUSH enrollment file, and that's regularly updated in CDW. We pull cost data and pharmacy data from the MCA, the Managerial Cost Accounting System, formerly known as VSS, and we take data from HERC average cost data, and these are regularly updated in CDW and Vinci. And as you'll see, one of the other variables that figures in our analytics is what's called a registry data set, and the Allocation Resource Center in Braintree develops that, and we request that annually from the ARC. So this system requires a fair amount of work just to keep it going and data inputs across a number of systems. So the hope is that we can keep this going in the future relatively easily. The registries, just to give you a sense of what the registries are, these are registry numbers, and VA has a number of registries out there. But you'll see in the analytics later on is that the registry is one way of boosting the statistical fit of the risk adjustment model. So let me tell you a little bit about the inputs for the IC9 codes. So and here's the table. I'm not going to walk you through all this, you know, specific. We try to pull as much IC9 diagnostic information as possible across the different files. So you'll see that we're using the PM files, the PMO files, the XM files. We're using what's known as the SE files from the outpatient side. And we even make use of the IE files and those are the inpatient encounters. So that if you're familiar with Medicare data, that would be a lot like the Part B for inpatient care. Again, we're just trying to get as much a sense on the clinical risk of these populations as possible. You might see data sets that are missing off the top, and that most notably what's missing is non-VA use. And by that, I mean not fee-basis care, but things like if you're using a commercial carrier or Medicare provider for your care, we do not easily see that. There's a lag in those data. So there's a group with geriatrics and extended care, Bruce Kenosian, Karen Phibbs, and Orna Intrator, who are working to develop and figure out how much it changes the models, the NOSOS models, if you include the Medicare data. And they're also trying to innovate and develop ways of building in frailty into the model. That's the kind of creativity I hope this engenders in more people. So here are the fee basis purchase care files that we pull against. So we take the ancillary, the inpatient, and the medicine files, and we pull as much as information as we can out of these as possible. These are just yearly pulls. Another question that's come up in sort of the theoretical discussions about risk adjustment is whether we should use multiple years of data. So in future iterations, one of the things that we're interested in is further testing on does the model fit get better if you use more than 1 year of data? And one of the questions then becomes, do you treat data that's 2 years old the same as data that's 1 year old, or do you have a decay rate in the sort of the, how you weight those data? So there's a lot of potential research for this in the future. So hopefully if at this point you're just interested in accessing the data, you're sufficiently excited about the data, and you can go from here and say, okay, we're going to use these data sets and we'll run with them. We know how to access them. Or if you don't know how to access them, at least you have a sense of who to contact and where to get more information for them. Now, if you're one of the critical people out there that want to know what's under the hood of these systems, the remainder of the talk is going to be talking much more about the specifics. Let me stop here, though, before we do that and just make sure and figure out if there's any questions out there.
And if anyone does have questions, please use that question pane and go to webinar on that dashboard. All questions are coming in writing today, so that is your way to send questions in.
I'm not seeing anything right now, so do I just assume, Heidi, that people are all happy? Either that or they're in the Northeast and they're snowed under and they can't survive.
Or they're writing incredibly long, complex questions. Those are the three options.
I like those. Those are always very much welcome. So obviously the snowed under is less welcome if you're in Boston, right?
Exactly. So you did have one question that just came in if you want to. Oh, a couple of them. If you want to take a look at those.
Sure. I am struggling to see these now.
Okay. The questions we have here. So you used VA specific cost experience to calibrate, and was it specific to each treating facility?
VA specific cost to calibrate and specific, and I just want to make sure, yes, we did use VA specific cost to create our risk models for each person. So we're, in some sense, what you do is and you'll see more in this next section, you create a statistical model that is the person's total spending in a given fiscal year. And that is for that person, irrespective of which facility they went to. For example, if you had a snowbird who lived half the year in Boston and was lucky enough to live the winter in Florida, this model takes their total cost and uses their total clinical information, even if they use more than one of VA medical center. Hopefully. So it's not a facility-specific risk adjustment. It's not to say, hey, for the summer, the person's using the Boston Jamaica Plain campus, and in the winter, the person is using the Gainesville VA campus, And here's the risk adjustment for each of those two campuses. It's a fiscal year view for the person. Hopefully that answered the question. So let me move on, and then if more questions come in, I'm happy to address them. And like always, if you have to leave before the end and I don't answer your question, or if you think of a question later, you're always welcome to contact us and me. So we had two aims when we set out to develop this. And at the time when we started this, we didn't know that we're going to be building Gnosis. The question was really, how do DXCG and D21 risk scores compare? And we originally thought that we would compare DXCGs to all of the other risk software out there. It's just that that question became too intractable. And the reason for using the V21 is because it's free. And so it's in the public domain, and it's supported by Medicare, and it's used for all the Medicare Advantage plans. And so it was relatively easy for us to say, well, it's a freeware version that's being continually supported. We believe it will be supported in the future. And so the question then we sort of made it easier was, let's just compare V21 to the DXCG. The second aim is, what is gained by adding additional clinical information to the V21 score? Can we recalibrate the risk scores to fit VA data better? And what do we gain when we do that? So I'll spend the first part of this remainder of the talk talking about the aim one. And then the second part is going to be, we can add additional clinical information. And as you'll see, not to take away all my thunder, but the pharmacy, again, we come back to this issue of pharmacy, and I'll explain why pharmacy makes a difference here. So we created six study samples, and I just want to walk you through these study samples. You could imagine a general sample. The general sample works great. When you start thinking about risk adjustment, though, many people are not just interested in a general study. They're interested in a slice of that general sample. And so one of the questions, if you create a risk adjustment system that works for the vast majority, it might perform very poorly for any specific subsample. And so we created a bunch of subsamples. We were interested in the general sample. We were also interested in high-cost veterans, those veterans that were defined as being in the top 5% of costs in a given fiscal year. We were also interested in patients with mental health substance use disorders. A fourth sample was all patients over age 65, so older adults. And you can think of those as also being the ones that are using primarily the Medicare system, but not necessarily. And then veterans with multimorbidity. I'll tell you how we defined multimorbidity, but you can think of those as being sicker patients. And then the sixth one is, we call it healthy veterans. It's probably better to call it low-risk veterans, and I'll tell you a little bit about how to define that sample. We really struggled to define a low-risk or healthy sample, in part because many of those people are not using the VA regularly. And so if you're using only administrative data to see people, what you're not seeing is the people who are healthy and not needing care. So how do you define healthy or low risk among users is a challenge. So let me just walk you through the numbers here. So for the general sample, we took 2 million randomly selected veterans. For the high-cost users, as I said, these are the most costly 5%. And most costly, we based that on the HERC national cost. And one reason for doing that, if you took the most costly 5% based on the MCA data, is you would more likely pull out patients who are in high cost or in areas where there's high wages. Palo Alto, where I am, is the wages here for clinicians are 68% higher than the national average. That cost gets passed on in some sense to the patients, and so their patient costs are higher. So we didn't want a sample that was disproportionately made up of people in Seattle, San Francisco, LA, Boston, for example. We wanted the national estimate. Mental health and substance use, we're interested in all patients with a mental health and substance use disorder. And here we worked over and connected with the mental health operations group and used their diagnostic code so that we could say something back to that operations team about risk adjustment. And then older people, that age is relatively easy based on date of birth. Multimorbidity, again, there's a lot of debate about what multimorbidity means. We use the AHRQ body indicator, and these are create systems, body systems indicators. And we said if you had more than two body system indicators, so, for example, you might have a disease of the respiratory tract and a disease of the cardiovascular system, that would get you into this multi-morbid system. And then healthy or low risk is defined as sort of the inverse of you were not multimorbid. So that means you had one or fewer body system indicators. We also wanted to make sure that you were using VA for the majority of your care. That's a very tough thing to observe. So we said, well, let's just take a V code for a physical. And the belief is if you got a physical at VA, it's more likely that you're getting most of your care at VA. And, of course, that's just an assumption, but that was how we operationalized it. So here's the AHRQ body system indicators. Obviously, the ones in light gray don't apply to VA or to VA in sufficient numbers that we would define multimorbidity based on 11 or congenital anomalies or you know conditions originating from the perineal period. So we excluded those. So, for example, multimorbidity might be, as I said, respiratory and circulatory 7 and 8. It might be something like digestive and circulatory or nerve and cancer would be a neoplasm. These are all based on diagnostic information. Outcomes. So what we're interested in is understanding how these clinical information predict costs. And so we're going to take the total cost in the current year, and at that point we used FY10 and the prospective year, and we used FY11. And so we're going to use, in this case, we're using the data from the MCI. So, I've sort of made the switch to calling it managerial cost accounting. I know some people still in their mind think it's DSS, so I put that DSS there, but the name is officially MCI. And then we use the fee basis cost in there as well. As we mentioned earlier with the data tables and the MedSAS tables that you can see, we're pulling against the VA care to understand their utilization and diagnostic information. So we're using the NPC to the National Patient Care Database, which is for outpatient care. It's actually, I should say, it's the SE file and the IE file that populate that. It's all based on clinician coding versus the PTF, which is inpatient care based on professional coders. We're getting the MCA information for pharmacy and then and as well as costs and then the HERC average cost data. Fee basis files are also included. So descriptive statistics, and you'll quite quickly see, so general sample, we have almost 2 million people. That was our goal, to have 2 million people in the general sample. We have 1.99 million. You can see across the top N is the number in our sample size. So overall in this general sample, you'll see that the average age was 62. When you get into people over age 65, you can see the number goes up. And the high cost, we see that the average age is 62, very similar to the general sample. And so forth. The healthy group looks younger. Let's move on to the fifth row, which talks about the mean average total cost, or I should say fourth row. So in the general sample, you'll see that it's about $8,800 per person per year is the cost. Over age 65, it decreases a little bit. And we've been doing some work looking at over age 65, and one can imagine or have theories about why that might be the case. The high cost, so here's one that clearly jumps out at you. So again, this was defined based on cost, so it's not a surprise. But high cost, these top 5%, when you sum all of their care up, account for over 50% of all VA costs. So the average for this group is $77,000 in expenditures. Mental health substance use, you get to see that it's, again, it's quite high. It's $15,000, multimorbid, or $21,000. And then healthy. So the means seem to be playing out. This, healthy is considered a low risk. Again, it's very difficult to define this, and we only came up with 78,000 people in that sample. But it gives you – the other interesting thing is to keep an idea on the maximums there. So when you get to the high cost, the maximum is almost $3 million. That's a large maximum. And you can see the standard deviation. That standard deviation, by the way, matters a lot when you talk about model fit. And we'll see that we're going to these risk adjustment models work well overall, but they're going to struggle on certain populations, specifically populations where there's high standard deviation. Sometimes it's very hard to predict that variance. Now it gets even more complicated. So you're going to compare these risk scores, and you can talk about different regression models. One can easily say, well, let's just compare all these risk models using ordinary least squares or multiple linear regression. Well, then you might say, well, we know that when we're dealing with cost data that we've got these non normally distributed cost information. Maybe we take the sort of log OLS or semi-log models, another way of thinking of it. So we'll transform the data. There's another transformation that Maria Rasmont has got us onto, which is the square root OLS model. There's less research published on this in cost information, but there's some data suggesting that it performs quite well. So we use that as well, square root OLS model. There's other types of regression, general linear models with gamma distribution of log lengths. There are concerns in the sort of peer-reviewed literature about overfitting that happens with these models. But again, they provide quite good fits in many circumstances. So we tried that as well. We tried the GLM with the square root link. So quite quickly, you're going to see that we're going to have a lot of different regression models that we're going to be comparing against. And each one of these regression models, we're going to use the same covariates, which is the age squared, gender, and the risk score provided by the different software platforms. So we're trying to standardize as best we can. So just to give you sort of average risk scores, so the first column is the V21. So this is prospective without any pharmacy information. You'll see that on average, the general population gets a 0.75. You can see that there's quite a bit of discrepancy across the system. So in other words, the system matters. And if you just follow that first row, you'll see that, you know, it matters whether it's prospective or concurrent. And typically concurrent does a little bit better fit just because you're using the same cost and clinical information. You'll see a much higher risk score, though, with the prospective with pharmacy, and especially true when the healthy get to the last row, which is the healthy population. So it's not shocking that that's got a lower average risk score healthy compared to the general population. But you'll also see that there's quite a boost there when you include the pharmacy information. That's going to be, a recurring theme, is that many people don't use a lot of care but might use pharmacy to stay sort of in this low-risk group. And you can think about people being hypertensive, people with high cholesterol, are often taking multiple medications but using very little care otherwise. And so sometimes this pharmacy information can be very informative. So how do the risk scores fit the DEA data? So, you know, I've already confused you probably with all of the different risk regression models that one can run. Now I'm going to make it even worse and say, well, there's different criteria on which you could score each of these risk models. You could say, well, let's look at R-squared. We could look at the root mean squared error, mean absolute error, or Hosmer-Lemeshow goodness of fit test. You know, we tried to produce all of these. It is a bewildering amount of information. I will try not to overwhelm you all. What we ended up focusing heavily on is one is the R-squared, just because it's so easy to compare across different systems. But we also use the Hosmer-Lemeshow goodness of fit statistics. What that does is it breaks the groups into deciles and says across each decile, how does the risk model fit the data? And you expect the data to fit better in the middle of the distribution and worse at the ends of the distribution. And this provides direct insight onto how well it's fitting the tails of the distribution. So that's one of the reasons we liked these Hosmer-Lemeshow goodness of fit tests. So let me just, I'm going to attenuate the results, and I hope you'll spare me some ability to do so and not present all of the different tables, because I don't want to put you to sleep. But here's the R-squared. We have four different risk models, and I'm just showing you the square root OLS model. Throughout the remainder, largely for the remainder of the talk, I'm going to present you the square root OLS model. It worked so well, I was very surprised. And so that ended up being our preferred regression model. It fit the data better than the semi-log. It fit the data better than the OLS. And we often had convergent problems with GLM. Now, there's smearing that's required when it comes to square root OLS. But if you're interested in that, I can talk to you more about that offline. So let me just try to walk you through this table in an abbreviated fashion. First, let's look at the R-squared, and you can see overall the general, you've got an R-squared of 0.428 with the prospective model. That's not great, and you see that the model actually improves with the DCG, depending on which DCG model you're up to. But if you take the last column, you get a 0.57 roughly. So there's quite a boost in the fit of the model if you're using the DCG model with RX. And that's consistent across. And take the last row and look across the healthy subgroups, and you can see that the DXCG software does a very good job, much better than the V21 when you're getting into the healthy low-risk group. So our sort of conclusion at this point, if you were just to look at these data, is to say, well, should VA use version 21 of the CMS or continue to purchase software? That wasn't my decision, but I would have probably recommended purchasing software at that point. And so across all the different specifications, you know, whether it's root mean squared error, there's other ones, you can see that mean absolute error. You can see that, and here's the Hosmer-Lemeshow test, these are the deciles. You can see that the DXCG software does very well, and in many cases does better than the version 21 software. So you might conclude, like what I did, which was that you would probably want to purchase the DXCG data at this point. So the first analysis was just comparing off-the-shelf measures and with the and when we get to concurrent risk, we would say the DXCG offers concurrent risk scores. The V21 does not. And the concurrent risk models tend to produce better fit statistics than prospective risk models. That's very consistent with literature. And again, we would have concluded that in many regards, the DXCG offers better fit than V21, which does not include the pharmacy data. So that sort of gave pause to many people on the team saying, well, do we continue to purchase the data? And that led us to the second aim, which was, could we boost our models, these V21 models? And I know we're starting to run out of time, so I'm going to try to go through this second set relatively quickly and talk about how we remodeled the VA data with the new information that's in here. And I see that there's a question that came up, which is, did you use the weights that CMS provides for the V21, or do you remodel with VA-specific costs? So all of our data here, we use for when we use the CMS version 21, it gives you weights that come out based on the diagnostic information that's provided by your patients. And yes, what's going to happen with AIM-2 is developing our own risk score using the V21 information risk score along with some additional clinical information. So this is what we end up thinking about as our NOSOS model. So we're going to add more covariates to the model. So we realize that, you know, we can include race, marital status, other health insurance. We're going to include things like the exposure registries. Amy Rosen, a number of years ago, developed these psychiatric condition categories. And as you know, VA thinks of itself as a critical component of the safety net. We have a large group of the veterans who use the system have much more defined psychiatric and substance use issues. So we wanted to use Amy's psychiatric HCCs. So we include those 46 in the model, and we had to update those. And then the question, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to include pharmacy data in the model. Whoops. So one way was we thought the easiest thing is going to be just prior year's pharmacy spending. That actually didn't work very well. And what worked out very well is PBM, the Pharmacy Benefits Management Group, has this variable with the pharmacy data called drug class category, and there are 26 drug classes. And there are other similar classification systems out there outside of VA, but what we ended up doing was creating dummy variables for each drug class and saying, did you have any or no use of this medication in this class in the prior year? And as you'll see, that pharmacy information, just even at that rough level, provided a substantial boost to our model. So, like I said, we have the PBM maintains this alphanumeric list of 580 drug types within 29 drug classes. Three of the classes were rarely used, and we resulted in a list of 26. Here they are, just to give you a sense, you know, antihistamines, blood-related agents, topical agents, oral agents, and so forth. So how do these, when you include, here's the V21, your first column is your prospective without pharmacy, and then we get the NOSO. So, you know, we're getting much better fits. We're boosting our fit here. And in many regards, the NOSOS works quite well compared to DXCG. There are two reasons, if you were to dig further under the hood, there are two reasons why these models work well. One is the registry information, and I have a theory about it, but it's hard to explicitly test it. One is the registry data works well because it's a historical information about exposures that might not always be seen time in and time out. So whether it's Agent Orange or a neurologic condition, those things manifest slowly over time, and so you might having that historical information might matter for risk adjustment. And then clearly the pharmacy information matters here. And so you'll see that our models produce quite good fits. We were quite happy with these as we went. And let me again go down to the healthy group. We often really struggle to fit models in this subsample just because there's not a lot of clinical information. And here again, the pharmacy data are critical. You get to see the boost is substantial when you're looking at the pharmacy information, in part because my theory is that you've got all these people who are taking medications but perhaps not seeing the doctors for a lot of diagnostic coding that would get them into a higher category, risk category. Again, here's the Hosmer-Lemma show. I know that we're running out of time, so I don't want to belabor this, but hopefully you've been able to download these slides, and you could always contact me if you have further questions about the Hosmer-Lemma show. So then you can use the regression models to predict a person's cost and then divide it by the average predicted cost. And this recalibrates the model such that the average person in VA would have a risk score of 1. We then did split sample validation. So if you were to do your risk models with the entire sample, there could be a concern that your particular risk model is working really well because you overfit the data. Well, if you break your sample into two random groups, one as a 50% random sample, you build your model on that, and then you predict it on the other sample, which is called split sample validation. You get to test whether you're overfitting the data. And robust findings suggest that you're not overfitting the data. So we did split sample validation with these techniques. So here's, just to give you a sense, and this is the NOSO's predicted risk score across our samples. So as you would expect, because it's been recalibrated around one, you get somebody in the general sample who has an average of risk score of 1. The minimum is 0.14, so that is what you would say is a low-risk person. The maximum is a 41 in the data, so you've got some people out there of what you would say is extreme risk. If you go up to the multimorbid and high-cost samples, those people may not be in the general sample. These were pulled independently, and you get to see that there are people out there with even higher risk scores, the maximum, almost 46. And then if you take the average for the healthy group, a smaller group, you'll see that the risk score is considerably below 1, but there are some higher outliers for that. We have a couple people above 10. So that's your predicted risk score from this NOSOS model. Let me just, again, the model matters, and one of the reasons why we use square root OLS is that you get to see there's a boost there from 0.31 in the OLS model to 0.43. Notable gains from the pharmacy data. So, you know, just sort of moving across the rows, you get to see without pharmacy, and then you can compare that with the pharmacy. And again, you have these boosts when you include the pharmacy data. And here's the recalibrated. So again, you get to see considerable boosts when you include the pharmacy data for VA. So I was quite happy with it. And I know that we're coming to the end of the time. What I hope, and I don't want to say that this is the end of risk adjustment, I hope actually that this inspired you to think of ways of improving the system. One of the things I'm hoping to do over the future is develop ways for the research community to improve on this system, whether it is to use multiple years of data or develop new fitting models, whether it's what the GEC folks are doing and trying to figure out a way to include frailty. I would much rather this system sort of live on by its users, and I think we can probably continue to improve upon it for version 2 and 3 and so forth. Main limitation, it's really just a comparison of two systems, the V21 and the DXCG. And I will also note that DXCG continues to modify and improve their system, so it's really just a snapshot in time. We haven't been concerned with gaming at this point. And as I mentioned earlier, the VA has a separate system for payment, which is VERA, than what we've been creating here. So NOSOS is not being used for payment. Like I said, we have to figure out how to move these things to ICD-10. That will be a big challenge for us. And then I really hope that there's opportunities for collaborations in future versions. And I've mentioned this, there's a lot of discussion about how do you include social and behavioral settings into this. And I know that some of that's been led by folks in the UK about do you put in your home environment where people live as a risk, as a social risk, into a model like this. So, and here's all the references that go into a lot of this stuff. So if you're interested in that and more, I can provide much more information on that. And then I think this is, so if you have questions, feel free to email me. I see that there is one more question, I think that's, or I might have answered that already. I think I answered that already. Did you use weights with this? Yes, I did. So if you're interested in access, I can connect you with Mei Ling Chen. If you're interested in more of the questions about the development of this and how to use these risk scores or how to improve upon them, I welcome those questions as well, and just shoot me an email.
Great. Thanks so much, Todd. We do have one, actually a couple of questions that did come in previously, and one of them was just confirming that you use the VA-specific cost experience to calibrate your models.
So the cost data that's going into this is the VA-specific cost information from the MCA data sets in addition to purchase care.
Great.
Now, John Cashy, and you'll see on our technical report, has done such an amazing job with our fee basis care that you can actually run different versions of this depending on whether you want to use costs incurred in the year or payments incurred in the year. I think that's how we defined it. So there's different ways of looking at fee basis data.
Okay. And were your cost models specific to each treating facility?
No, they were specific to the person in the fiscal year. So, like I said, if someone used across multiple facilities, this is just going to be a summary risk score for that person rather than the person per facility.
Great. Well, that looks to be all the questions that we currently have, and I think we are actually at the top of the hour. So thank you so much, Todd, for a wonderful presentation.
Thanks. Hopefully people are not totally confused, but if you are, if you have any other questions, feel free to reach out to us. And thank you, Risha, for your support, and also Heidi.
We are happy to help out. Thank you, Todd, so much for preparing and presenting for today's session. For the audience, I am just about to close the session. When I do that, you will be prompted for a feedback form. If you all could take just a few moments to fill that out, we really do read through all of your feedback, and it allows us to make changes to improve our program. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar, and we hope to see you at a future session. Thank you.